Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 267. It's Monday, July 29th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, let's get to it with an update on an annual ranking for Ohio. This is from the American Fitness Index from the American College of Sports Medicine. Well, we're kind of dragging the bottom here. Out of the 100 largest cities, Toledo ranks 87th. And they have two basic sets of metrics. That's measuring personal health and the community environment. So on the personal health rank, Toledo comes in dead last at ranked 100th out of 100 cities. Yikes. Although we pull up to 87th overall ranking by sneaking into the top third of rankings, ranking 32nd among the top 100 cities for community environment rank, which would include one thing, for instance, supportive like, our park systems and such. And this is not wildly different from what from the 4 years that they've done this. We've hung out here roughly in that same neighborhood of low fitness. Okay, well, next up I have a special treat. This is a very interesting article that falls almost in a category by itself. It's a landmark study on cancer and pesticides. I found three different large news agencies that reported on this. I was completely dissatisfied with the way they reported on it. It was misleading in my judgment, and in fact, I did not even want to have my listeners go and read those particular articles because there were fatal flaws in how misleading there were. I'm not even going to talk about the ways they're misleading because one of the things about education and learning is that if we hear falsehoods, we tend to remember them, even if you spend an inordinate amount of time trying to disabuse people of those falsehoods. It's one reason why propaganda works so well. Okay, well, on to this study. This was a comprehensive assessment of pesticide use patterns and increased cancer risk, published in the Frontiers in Cancer Control and Society. This is a landmark study, the first of its kind. It's very comprehensive. It looks at 69 different pesticides. And this is really important because there's a lot of research showing individual pesticides being carcinogenic and related to various types of cancer. But this handles pesticides individually and, most importantly, covers multiple exposures together. And this is controlled for major confounders. They found substantial effects. And of course, this is a county-by-county analysis. So that's the unit. It's looking obviously at individual incidents of cancer, and not cancer deaths, but cancer incidents, which is slightly different, but on the county level. So this is not really getting at, like, for instance, food exposure you might get because the food that's produced in one county would go, you know, all over the country and even the planet. So it's really about the local regional exposure based on land use, agricultural land use, and pesticide exposure. So they did find that, in fact, cancer caused by pesticides is a real thing and substantial. But to put that in context, okay, if you look at the incidence of cancer in the U.S., one overall study that I will also put a link to shows that 42% of risk factors are like controllable risk factors within the control of the individual, at least somewhat. Now, about almost half of that is cigarette smoking. That is by far the largest individual risk factor. The next would be excessive body weight, overweight, and obesity. Then would come alcohol, and then UV radiation, which of course is primarily malignant skin cancers. Okay, then would come diet, which is a variety of things, low fruit and vegetable, low fiber, not eating a lot of processed or red meat, that type of thing. And then you have a variety of infections. That would be HPV infection, which is associated with a number of cancers, primarily cervical cancer. HIV infection causes cancer, Kaposi's sarcoma. H. pylori infection, which is a stomach infection, can lead to stomach cancer. Hepatitis C infections can lead to liver cancer. So those combined, those kind of infections that lead to cancer would be the next category. And just below that would fall the order, basically, of what we're seeing, what this pesticide use on farms and the vicinity would produce. Just to put that in the context. And that was the major context. It was not provided by the journalists who were covering this article. And frankly, it was very hard to tease out. This is a very long article that I combed through to try to come up with the best way to present that. So the bottom line is, this is a landmark study that documents that pesticide use of dozens and dozens and dozens of pesticides leads to some cancers more specifically, but most importantly, overall, it is a substantial risk factor for cancer. Of course, changing our agricultural practice and pesticide use is a monumental task. And for those of us in Lucas County, the huge stretch of increased pesticide cancer exposure risk, we're on the very eastern kind of end of a swath that goes all the way through Iowa and a little farther where the highest risk is, associated most predominantly with corn production. And of course, corn production is only nominally used for food. Most of it's used for biofuel and things that are food-like products, which I would call like corn starch, corn syrup, and even corn oil. Okay, well, next up, to put that story in further context, let's talk about adult smoking cessation. This from the CDC. In 2022, the majority of the 29 million U.S. adults who smoke cigarettes wanted to quit. Approximately one half tried to quit, but fewer than 10% were successful in the year 2022. Fewer than 40% of adults who smoked used treatment, that would be their counseling and or medication, when trying to quit. One half received clinician advice or assistance to quit. Compared with adults who smoked non-menthol cigarettes, those who smoked menthol cigarettes had similarly low quit rates, despite a higher quit attempt prevalence, potentially related to lower treatment use. And of course, if you or someone you care about smokes cigarettes, you can call 1-800-QUIT-NOW and get linked to resources to quit. 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Smoking is the single largest preventable cause of death. It's the single largest preventable cause of cancer, and actually causes way more heart disease deaths than cancer, although cancer, lung cancer, seems to be the signature that people recognize with smoking. Okay, well, let's do a couple of stories on teen health, and these happen to be a little bit better news. First from Axios, big declines in teen birth, CDC data shows. Teen birth rates in the United States have continued to decline significantly across the board since the year 2000, but racial and ethnic disparities still exist, new federal data shows. Why it matters? Decreasing teen births can positively affect adolescents' physical and mental health, lifetime income, and educational attainment, according to the research organization Child Trends. Black, Native American, and Hispanic teenagers of any race still had higher birth rates in 2022 than white non-Hispanic teens, but Hispanic teens saw the steepest declines in teen birth rates between 2000 and 2022. The overall birth rate for 15 to 19-year-olds in the United States declined 71% between 2000 and 2022. Additionally, there was an 80% decline in the rate of teens with one or more births after their first child, so somebody having two or more kids while a teenager. Research shows that having a second child as a teenager makes it even harder for parents to finish school and can increase the risk of poverty and adverse outcomes for children. The decline of teen births stems from less sexual activity among teen girls and increased use of contraception among sexually active teenagers, according to the CDC. A good trend. Okay, well, teen drug use has declined in recent years, and this is a story about misusing prescription meds. This is from Medical Express. Big drop in U.S. kids and teens misusing prescription meds. Misuse of illicit prescription drugs is falling dramatically among U.S. high school students, a new study says. The percentage of seniors who say they've misused prescription drugs in the past year has dropped to 2% in 2022, down from 11% back in 2009, researchers reported in the journal JAMA. To put these findings in context, the reduction over the past decade was like going from 1 in every 9 high school students using prescription drugs non-medically down to 1 in every 40 high school students, said researcher Sean Esteban McCabe, director of the U of M Center for Study of Drugs, Alcohol, Smoking, and Health. For the study, researchers tracked trends regarding the three types of prescription drugs most commonly misused by teens: opioids, stimulants, which for example would be Ritalin or Adderall, and benzodiazepines, which are drugs like Xanax or Valium. They used data collected by the University of Michigan as part of the annual survey of high school students. Not only has illicit drug use declined, but even legitimate use for medical reasons has dropped among teens. About 16% of high school seniors said in 2022 they've ever been prescribed one of these drugs for health reasons, down from 24% in 2009. The means of getting a prescription drug for illicit use also has changed over time, with signs indicating it's gotten harder for teens to find these pills. About 37% of teens now say they got a prescription for drugs they've misused, whereas in 2009, students said they most often got the drugs from a friend. Further, the percentage of teens who say they have multiple sources for illicit prescription drugs has declined from 56% in 2009 to only 29% in 2022. And the percentage of teens who think it would be impossible to get prescription drugs for misuse increased from 36% to 49%. These trends could be due to school closures during the pandemic, which limited the amount of contact students had with another, McCabe said. Opportunities to sell or give away prescription drugs to friends declined. It could also be due to tightened regulations and practices around prescribing these drugs as a result of the opioid epidemic, researchers added. Prescribing practices have changed dramatically because we have an opioid epidemic, which turned into a heroin epidemic, and we're still reeling from that, especially with fentanyl. A lot of this has to do with parents having better knowledge and oversight of these medications. Okay, well, next up we have a story that kids need to disproportionately deal with, as well as parents. This from Medical Express. Moms and caregivers facing family food insecurity need help with more than just food. People don't experience food insecurity the same way. Often it's the mothers who first change their eating habits when food runs low to shield others, especially children, from its effects. Mothers experience negative mental health impacts due to household food insecurity, especially if they are the ones going without food or using a sizable portion of it. This evidence shows that a mother's mental health suffers based on who in the household is affected by food insecurity. Moms in households with any food insecurity had worse mental health and had to use more strategies to cope with a food shortage compared to moms in food secure households. They also reported higher anxiety and depression levels than those in food secure homes. According to the researchers, this shows the need for strategies to help moms or caregivers manage their mental health when someone in the household is experiencing food insecurity. Besides nutrition education and managing food resources, additional support is needed to help mothers or caregivers with their mental health. Food insecurity or security is not a constant state. According to the researchers, it's been shown to happen more during the holidays or during summer when school meals are not offered. Well, first of all, as a public health nutritionist, I find the solutions that are offered about offering mental health assistance to families that are suffering from food insecurity seems a little bizarre to me. I would go up to actually providing food. Maybe that would solve the root problem. Let's just not train people to cope better with not having enough food. Let's solve food insecurity in the first place, for goodness sake.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? from daily sexism that can't be mansplained away, from endemic racism that nobody seems to see. Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up we have a story that also gets at the vulnerability of families, particularly. This from Medical Express. U.S. infant deaths rise for the first time in decades. For the first time in two decades, the infant mortality rate in the United States has risen, new government data shows. In a report released by the CDC, researchers found that more than 20,500 babies died in 2022 before the age of one. Overall, there were 5.6 infant deaths for every 1,000 live births, which is a 3% increase from the year before. Infant health is one of the most important public health indicators that we have, said Amanda Jean Stevenson, a demographer and assistant professor of sociology at the University of Colorado. The fact that infant mortality rates are not continuing to decrease is a very big deal. Even flat infant mortality rates are not good, she added. We need to see these numbers going down, and fast, because they are far too high. In the United States, infant mortality has been generally trending down since at least 1995, but rates are still much higher in this country than they are in many other developed nations. Why are more infants dying? The leading causes of infant mortality stayed the same between 2021 and 2022. Congenital malformations led at nearly 1 in 5 deaths. Another 14% was caused by disorders related to short gestation and low birth weight, followed by sudden infant death syndrome, unintentional injuries, and maternal complications. But the rate of infant deaths from maternal complications jumped 9% between 2021 and 2022, from about 30 infant deaths for every 100,000 live births to more than 33 per 100,000 live births. None of the other leading causes of infant death increased significantly, the report found. Infant health is tied tightly to maternal health, and the United States has struggled for years with high rates of death among women during pregnancy, childbirth, or postpartum. COVID may also play a role in the rise in infant mortality in 2022. Infections in pregnant women during major surges in 2021 could have affected infants born in 2022. Last year, a large study found that pregnant women who got COVID were nearly four times more likely to be admitted to an intensive care unit than those who weren't infected. They were also 15 times more likely to be ventilated and 7 times more likely to die. Not only that, but they face higher risks of preeclampsia, blood clots, and problems caused by high blood pressure. Meanwhile, babies born to moms who had COVID were at higher risk of preterm birth and low birth weights. In the latest report, the infant mortality rate was highest among black infants in 2022, with nearly 11 deaths for every 1,000 live births. But the rate among American Indian and Alaska Native infants spiked more than 20% in 2022 to more than 9 deaths for every 1,000 live births. The mortality rate among white infants increased but remained lower than most other racial and ethnic groups, with about 4.5 deaths for every 1,000 live births. Further complicating the reproductive health landscape, the U.S. Supreme Court revoked the federal right to an abortion in June 2022. Research published last month drew connections between infant mortality and abortion restrictions, finding that infant death spiked in Texas after the state passed a law in September 2021 that banned nearly all abortions beyond about 6 weeks of pregnancy. Among the 14 states who have passed near-total bans on abortion since the Supreme Court ruling, all but two had a higher-than-average infant mortality rate in 2022. The big context here is if you were actually going to pick one indicator for the community's public health, infant mortality would probably be the top pick. So the fact that that is going up is not a good sign. Okay, well, next up, I have a very interesting story that highlights the simple fact and reality that low-income folks, if given a little bit of a boost, can really improve their health. This from MedPage Today. More money could result in fewer emergency department visits. Giving cash to poor people could result in fewer emergency department visits, a new study suggests. The study in JAMA looked at almost 2,900 low-income people who applied for a lottery in the Boston suburb of Chelsea, Massachusetts. Nearly 1,750 of them got up to $400 per month from November 2020 to August 2021. The researchers then looked at health records and found that those who received the money had 27% fewer visits to the emergency department in the nine-month period compared with those who didn't receive the monthly payments. "We can trust the poor with money," the study author, Sumit Agarwal of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston said. "There's this narrative out there that if you give people cash and they spend it on drugs and alcohol, I think we're one of the first studies to really rigorously and empirically show that's not the case. The correlation between poverty and poor health outcomes is well established, but it's still unclear if increasing basic income in the U.S. could improve health outcomes. People in the study who received money used the emergency department less for medical issues related to behavior health and substance use. There were no significant differences between the two groups in regular doctor visits or prescriptions, though people with the added income used more outpatient specialty care. The cash recipients' financial stability seemed to decrease their stress level, which generally improved their health, leading to fewer emergency department trips." Yes, folks, if people have more money, they can be trusted to generally do actually what's good for them. Surprise, surprise. Well, next up, we have a story about it, you know, in healthcare. It's all about the money and the fact that turning down potential payers in your health system is happening. Yikes, shows how bad our system is. This from Becker's Hospital Review. 15 health systems dropping Medicare Advantage plans. Medicare Advantage provides health coverage to more than half the nation's older adults, but some hospitals and health systems are opting to end their contracts with Medicare Advantage plans over administrative challenges. Among the most commonly cited reasons are excessive prior authorization denial rates and slow payments from insurers. In January, the Healthcare Financial Management Association released a survey of 135 health system chief financial officers, which found that 16% of systems are planning to stop accepting one or more Medicare Advantage plans in the next 2 years. Another 45% said they are considering the same but have not made a final decision. The report also found that 62% of these chief financial officers believe collecting from Medicare Advantage is significantly more difficult than it was 2 years ago. So when you turn down money from potential clients or patients because it's too hard to get paid, just shows you where we're at with the financialization of our already crazy healthcare system, or lack thereof. Okay, well, this next story gets at a huge disconnect in how our healthcare non-system does not really provide training that really addresses the underlying needs and demographic shifts in our nation. This from Stat News. An aging geriatrician wonders, who will care for me? In 1988, I became one of the first U.S. physicians certified in the new specialty of geriatric medicine, which focuses on the health care of older adults. As an idealistic and optimistic 32-year-old geriatrician, I believe that this branch of medicine would undoubtedly emerge as a vibrant field of medicine, benefiting patients and society. I was also confident that when I reached older adulthood, the healthcare system would be ready to take care of me. I had been drawn to geriatrics for several reasons. I enjoyed caring for my older patients, and I valued their appreciation of the care I provided. I also realized that there were 76 million baby boomers out there. The U.S. was on the cusp of a dramatic demographic shift that would have profound implications for its healthcare system. It was obvious that many healthcare professionals and specialized expertise in caring for older adults would be needed, and I was excited to be among the first. The expected demographic changes were right on target. Over the past 20 years, the number of Americans 65 years of age and older has increased from 35 million to 58 million. By 2040, that number will swell to 78 million. But the U.S. healthcare system and its workforce haven't kept pace, and my optimism the system would be ready to care for me has faded. Age is associated with numerous health risks, including multiple chronic illnesses, over-medication, fall-related injuries, cognitive decline, and more. Geriatricians can help manage, delay, and even prevent many of these age-related health issues. Caring for older people with complex chronic conditions, prescribing medications that are safe and effective for them, and addressing functional and cognitive decline are essential skills for geriatricians. We also prioritize aligning our patients' preferences and values with their goals of care, and work hard to integrate the vital role served by family caregivers. Yet despite a clear demographic imperative, the number of healthcare professionals with special training, experience, and expertise in the care of older adults is declining. Fewer and fewer medical students and residents are choosing to become geriatricians. In 2023, only 174 of 419 geriatrics fellowship training positions were filled through the National Fellowship Specialty Match, the lowest percentage of all medical specialties. Reduced interest in geriatrics is also seen in other health professions, including among nurse practitioners. There are nearly 400,000 licensed nurse practitioners in the U.S. who play increasingly important roles in every healthcare setting. Yet the opportunity to become a geriatric nurse practitioner ended about 10 years ago, as very few pursued this specialized career path. Financial compensation, prestige, and respect are key factors that greatly influence the attractiveness of a specialty to medical students, residents, and nurse practitioners. Specialties like cardiology, oncology, and dermatology are substantially more lucrative than geriatrics, and those training programs have no trouble filling their slots. But the situation geriatric medicine faces cannot be attributed to just lower compensation and less prestige. Medical career decisions are also shaped by societal attitudes about aging. One study of medical students and residents training at two urban teaching hospitals in Northern California profiled the trainees' negative perceptions about older adults, including that they were inherently, quote, end of life, that they were cognitively impaired, and that their medical problems were complex and unlikely to be resolved, and that they were socially needy and slow to interact with. Some argue that all healthcare professionals should receive training in the care of older adults. I agree. Such training could reinforce the principles of geriatric care and temper the effects of societal ageism. Unfortunately, U.S. medical schools, residency training programs, and schools of nursing are falling far short of achieving this goal. It's not enough to assume that medical students, residents, and nurse practitioners will learn enough about caring for older adult patients simply because many of the patients they see in the hospital or in the clinic are old. Roseanne Leipzig, a geriatrician at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, has commented that all medical students are required to have clinical experience in pediatrics and obstetrics, even though after they graduate, most will never treat a child or deliver a baby. Yet with changing demographic landscapes, older adults will account for an increasing proportion of most healthcare providers' workloads over the coming years. Ironically, as reported at the 2024 annual meeting of the American Geriatric Society, only 1 in 10 U.S. allopathic and osteopathic medical schools has a required clinical experience in geriatrics, a decline from 1 in 4 in 2010. Some ongoing national efforts to promote the principles of geriatric care, supported by organizations like the American Geriatric Society and the John Hartford Foundation. The Hartford Foundation's Age-Friendly Health Systems Initiative, for instance, is a movement to improve the care of older adults that has spread to 3,000 healthcare sites across the U.S. Despite these efforts, the U.S. lacks a well-trained cadre of healthcare professionals with special expertise in geriatrics to lead the development of new programs to care for older adults, to train the next generation of healthcare professionals, and to assure high-quality care for the growing number of older Americans. The U.S. is just beginning to experience the full impact of its aging population. Regrettably, its healthcare system and workforce are inadequately prepared to handle the oncoming surge of multimorbidity, dementia, functional impairment, and frailty. The leaders of healthcare organizations and medical schools have either failed to recognize this or, worse, have opted to overlook it. I will never stop advocating for a healthcare system and a professional workforce fully prepared to care for our aging population. Unfortunately, I may be already too late. I am extremely worried about who will be there to care for me. And if I'm worried, you should be too. Amen. Yikes. Of course, since older folks are disproportionately represented in healthcare, those receiving healthcare, it would make sense that we train virtually all healthcare providers in geriatrics.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure health care for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for a year, you will know more than 99% of the population about public health. And if that shouldn't end up not being the case, I will gladly triple your money back. Okay, well, next up, let's move to a few infectious disease stories. First up from Axios. The years after COVID have turned into a post-flu vaccine era. Demand for flu shots is declining, particularly among some of the most medically vulnerable groups, raising concerns that the vaccines may be falling out of favor in a post-pandemic world. While uptake for flu shots has never been stellar, experts say vaccine fatigue, shifting attitudes, and lowered public trust may be eroding demand. When we saw this for the first year, we were like, okay, it's just coming out of a pandemic. There's all these COVID vaccines. This feels like a blip, said Stefan Merlo, vice president of commercial operations at a vaccine maker. We don't believe that anymore. The big picture, the CDC recommends everyone 6 months and older should get a flu vaccine each year. And last month, it recommended the 2024-2025 flu vaccines in addition to the updated COVID-19 vaccines. Half of U.S. adults did during the 2020 to 2021 respiratory virus season, but the rate has tailed off since then and was down to about 47% in 2023 to 2024. But that doesn't capture the full story, experts say, noting that the drop-off is largely being driven by the most vulnerable groups. About 70% of seniors got a vaccine in the 2022 to 2023 respiratory virus season, down from 75% in the 2020 to 2021 season. That's unusual because the group typically has very stable vaccination rates. Vaccinations among kids and adolescents dipped from 56% in the 2020 to 2021 respiratory virus season down to 47% in the 2023 to 2024 respiratory virus season, while uptake in pregnant people has slipped from 53% to 36%. Zooming in, the same patients that have been seen at Nemours Children's Health, where many parents who traditionally got their kids vaccinated are opting out, said Jonathan Miller, chief of pediatric primary care. It's a really disappointing trend, he said. I suspect that the COVID pandemic and a sort of political milieu during this time has had a lot of impact on vaccine confidence and an increase in vaccine hesitancy. There are likely multiple other factors at play, including the fact families have just gotten out of the habit of getting flu shots or other vaccinations. There may be confusion or vaccine fatigue for some individuals after receiving so many COVID-19 shots and potentially getting RSV vaccines for the first time. The bottom line is lowered vaccine rates may already be resulting in worse outcomes. Already, the CDC's preliminary estimates also show an overall rise in flu-related hospitalizations and deaths during the most recent flu season compared with prior seasons. The flu accounted for nearly half of all hospitalizations for infectious disease, including COVID-19 and RSV in the latest U.S. season. A spokesman for the CDC said the agency is concerned about drops in vaccinations, saying, quote, respiratory diseases can be very serious, especially among people at higher risk of developing serious complications. Yes, we have vaccines for vaccine-preventable illnesses, but we have to avail ourselves of them. Okay, let's do it. Of course, some people in the world don't have the ability to even avail themselves of such wondrous vaccines. This from Reuters. The World Health Organization sees high risk of polio spread across Gaza. The World Health Organization said there is a high risk of polio virus spreading across the Gaza Strip and beyond its borders due to the dire health and sanitation situation in the war-ravaged Palestinian enclave. Poliomyelitis, which is spread mainly through the fecal-oral route, is a highly infectious virus that can invade the nervous system and cause paralysis. It mainly affects children under the age of 5. Israel's military said it would start offering the polio vaccine to soldiers serving in the Gaza Strip after remnants of the contagious poliovirus was found in test samples in areas of the coastal enclave. The military also said that with the cooperation of international groups, enough vaccines have been brought in to cover more than 1 million people in Gaza, which has a total population of around 2.3 million. Although without proper health services, the population of Gaza is particularly vulnerable to outbreaks of disease, public health officials and aid groups said. I'm extremely worried about an outbreak happening in Gaza, and this is not only polio, but different outbreaks of communicable diseases. And of course, they're trying to deal with just, you know, onslaught of the ravages of war directly. And of course, their primary care system that would be responsible for delivering such vaccines has been decimated as well. Okay, well, next up, have some better news on infection control. This on the global front from The Guardian. Most new HIV infections occurred outside of sub-Saharan Africa for the first time. The majority of new HIV infections last year occurred in countries outside sub-Saharan Africa for the first time. African countries have made swift progress in tackling the virus recently, with the number of infections in sub-Saharan Africa 56% lower than in 2010, a new report from UNAIDS said. Globally, infections have fallen by 39% over the same period. For the first time in the history of the HIV pandemic, more new infections are occurring outside sub-Saharan Africa than in sub-Saharan Africa. This reflects both the prevention achievements in much of the sub-Saharan Africa region and the lack of comparable progress in the rest of the world. Case numbers are rising in Eastern Europe and Central Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, and North Africa. UNAIDS said the world is at a crossroads in efforts to tackle the virus, with action this year key to success. A backlash against human rights in many countries is making it harder for marginalized groups to access care, said Winnie Binyayima, executive director of UNAIDS. At the same time, services face funding shortfalls after cuts in aid, and with many low-income countries choking on debt that reduces domestic health spending. There is also a risk that game-changing new drugs that need only to be taken every few months to treat or prevent HIV will only be available in richer countries. Almost 10 years ago, global leaders agreed to end AIDS as a public health threat by 2030 in the UN Sustainable Development Goals. The world is not on track to succeed. The world can end AIDS by 2030, but that will depend on the actions of leaders, both government and corporate leaders, the actions they take today. In 2023, 40 million people across the world were living with HIV, according to a new report from UNAIDS. There were 1.3 million new HIV infections and 630,000 AIDS-related deaths, including 76,000 children. Dr. Sharon Lewin, president of the International AIDS Society, said the data showed that countries that commit to managing their epidemics, even in the poorest parts of the world, can indeed lower HIV infections. That is very exciting and inspiring, she said. The flip side of that is that the infections outside sub-Saharan Africa might be more challenging to get on top of. Lewin said infections were focused in marginalized groups, including people who injected drugs, sex workers, transgender women or gay men, who face discriminatory and punitive laws. This is not a biomedical issue. It's a societal issue, and that's a bigger challenge. It's vital to protect the human rights of everybody. The rates of HIV among gay men are lower where homosexuality is decriminalized. With new criminalization laws such as in Uganda, we have to work hard to keep the progress. The backlash on rights, this backlash against democracy, against the rights of women, against LGBTQ rights, is pushing people away from the services that have a right to. We need to have further progress on decriminalization, particularly in Africa, and we need to fight stigma and discrimination against people living with HIV and people at risk. Young women in sub-Saharan Africa remain particularly vulnerable. She called for policies to reduce the inequalities they face, including universal and free secondary education. In Eastern Europe and Central Asia, and the Middle East and North Africa, just 50% of people living with HIV are taking antiretroviral drugs that suppress the virus and reduce the risk of passing it on. Sub-Saharan Africa remains home to almost half of people living with HIV who have no treatment. Access is especially low among children, the report warned. Bianima said it was urgent that game-changing technology such as long-acting drugs to treat or prevent HIV, already available in places such as the U.S., be shared immediately with developing countries. If it's going to take another 6 years, 10 years, before prices come down for these countries, then we won't end AIDS, she said. But if we can move quickly to put that technology in the medicine's patent pool and have generics making it in a few years' time, we could get there. But she also called for a solution to the debt crisis, a restructuring of debt to free up resources, but also boosting aid. The report said resources were at their lowest level in more than a decade. Yep, that's kind of the cycle of public health. You deal with something, and once you start making some progress, it gets deprioritized, and you end up right back in the same boat. Okay, well, that brings us to our last feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increase enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give that link again at the end of the list. 39 bonus articles this week, so let's get to it. First up, rate of under-vaccinated Ohio kindergartners increases from 10.1% pre-pandemic to 13.8%, so over a one-third increase. This is particularly important with one of the most infectious and dangerous, measles, which you need about 95% protection, a vaccination to have herd immunity. And of course, we were at less than half of that. We are at 10% unvaccinated over or under vaccinated overall. That's a mix of ones that they're under vaccinated on. But of course, measles is the most important. And of course, these rates are not evenly distributed all the way through the state. There can be pockets, and that's when highly infectious things like measles can become a problem. Bonus article two, raccoon rabies vaccinations will drop from the sky in a Pennsylvania county to push back westward move of rabies. So there actually is a movement in the U.S. to get rid of, to eliminate rabies in the U.S. Ohio has had a problem, and they do these where they put out food for the raccoons that has a vaccination in it. They eat that, and it vaccinates them. So Pennsylvania is trying to push it further eastward. Thank you for protecting us, Pennsylvania, from rabies. Bonus article three, COVID activity continues at brisk pace across much of the U.S. So our summer wavelet is still happening, and Ohio's still lower than average, but it's been increasing like most of the rest of the nation. Bonus article four, triathlon cancels Olympic swim training for the second day over poor water quality. So Paris wanted to have them swimming in the Seine, but unfortunately, they haven't been able to clean it up enough to make it safe for humans to swim in it. Bonus article five, toxic forever chemicals found in pesticides that are used on food, in homes, and on pets, often present in inert ingredients and or proprietary, that is, secret formulas. So when you actually chemically analyze these compounds, these pesticides that are used in these various settings, you know, food, homes, and on pets, they actually find PFAS chemicals. Yikes, we're learning more and more about that every week. Bonus article six, supposedly eco-friendly tires still contain toxic chemicals. So there really wasn't any discernible difference between these so-called eco-friendly tires and the number of toxic chemicals that were present. Another example of greenwashing. Buyer beware. Bonus article seven, a large number of heat-related deaths in Phoenix are linked to substance abuse, primarily meth, which mass heat warning signs. So this is an interesting connection between climate change and substance use, and this is largely in homeless populations. In this example, in Phoenix, very, very hot, and people that are using meth, it makes you actually feel like you're cooler than you are, and that you're actually, you don't feel as warm, and you don't adapt as well. Your body, it's maladaptive as far as dealing with the heat, so it can be double or triply dangerous. Bonus article eight, we bought everything needed to make $3 million worth of fentanyl. All it took was $3,600 and a web browser. So this is an AP story just showing that trying to keep fentanyl out of the U.S. is nearly impossible. You can literally order these drugs, mail order them, and have a thousandfold profit from it. Fentanyl's unfortunately not that hard to make. So the idea of interdiction as a way to solve the fentanyl problem is probably a pipe dream, and perhaps a crack pipe dream. Bonus article nine, alcohol industry panics as healthier habits cut sales. So there's been shifts in recent decades. It used to be believed that, that moderate alcohol use actually had health benefits. That's proven not to be true. So that's the thing. And also people are switching to other things like cannabis. So that's cutting into alcohol sales. Although I can tell you that most of the alcohol that is sold is consumed by people that are averaging 10 or more drinks per day. So the alcoholics are keeping the alcohol industry going. Bonus Article 10, Regulatory Framework for Cannabis, a position paper from the American College of Physicians. If you're interested in such things, that the regulation of cannabis when it's legalized is important, keeping a safe supply of drugs. Bonus Article 11, a bird flu doom loop of industrial animal production. This is a little bit of a conundrum we're in because we have industrial concentrated animal feeding operations. That itself is a perfect and kind of a perfect storm for bird flu persisting and potentially switching to humans. So, you know, maybe our meat eating, egg eating, and milk drinking, cheese eating may actually have a major contribution to the next pandemic. Who knows? Bonus Article 12. With the U.S. bird flu outbreak uncontained, scientists see growing risks. This is a good overview article of the latest that's happening with bird flu. And to drill down a little bit, Bonus Article 13. Study raises questions about key features of bird flu infections in cows. It may kill them, plus asymptomatic animals can harbor virus. So first of all, they were thinking it didn't make them really sick. But like, you know, like say COVID, for instance, most people, it didn't actually even, it, like 40% of the people wasn't even symptomatic. But of course, asymptomatic folks with COVID and cows with bird flu, and I guess cow flu now, that they can transmit it. And in fact, that there's some that get sick enough that you have killed, they die off. They have to be killed because they get so sick. So that, of course, can be a driver for the economics of milk cows and cattle in general. Bonus Article 14. Are doctors missing cases of H5N1 bird flu in people who drink raw milk? So there's over a million people who drink raw milk on a weekly basis. And that's actually old stats. As I reported on earlier, that has actually gone up. Since there was a warning about getting bird flu from drinking raw milk has actually gone up. Yep. Welcome to America. Bonus Article 15, Colorado requires dairies to test milk for bird flu. So states have very different ways that they're dealing with it. Colorado is at least trying to do some surveillance by testing milk for bird flu. Bonus Article 16, could cow vaccines help halt the spread of bird flu in U.S. herds? Experts are divided. This is a really good read for the complexity and the importance of public health. Bonus Article 17, corporate influence of lobbyists, disinformation, and hyperpalatable products drive our epidemic of obesity. A good overview of how corporate influence can drive ill health in the U.S. and around the world. Bonus Article 18, should we take any personal responsibility for the obesity epidemic? So there's a long series, and I covered two last week on nutritionfacts.org, and this is kind of... the last thing is that it actually just posits the idea that there's so much kind of social determinants of health that trying to take any personal responsibility for the obesity epidemic makes increasingly less sense. And on the health front there, a diet front, bonus article 19, healthy vegan diet yields anti-aging effects, whereas healthy omnivorous diet does not. This was an interesting study, very well controlled, and the healthy vegan diet yielded anti-aging effects. And when they were instructed on the healthy omnivorous diet, that didn't make a difference. Bonus Article 20, pet obesity parallels human obesity rates. Not surprising, they live in similar environments, both corporate and household. Bonus Article 21, Surgeon General warns that Americans have accepted fear of gun violence as normal. Yep, we have a very violent culture, and of course we're starting to attenuate that. You just get... normal when you experience something long enough. Of course, normal doesn't necessarily mean well. Bonus Article 22. Maryland is on track to process a nearly 50-year-old backlog of rape kits. So the good news is that they're doing it all, but there was a whole pool of ones that were kind of outside of the regulations about being processed, that they're taking care of that. But my God, half a century? Get serious, people. We can do better. Bonus Article 23. Social vulnerability linked with mental health and substance use disorders. This is sort of common sense, but another example that our social vulnerability can drive mental health and substance use disorders. It's not simply some chemical imbalance in our brains that just randomly kind of shows up. Bonus article 24, Sonia Massey's death, the woman who was shot in the face by a police officer. How to prevent more killings of defenseless black women through crisis intervention training, which only 1 in 6 police agencies have. So, of course, that can get at police being better prepared to deal with crises. In this case, it was simply homicide. The guy should not have been a cop, period. There's another intervention needed for that. Bonus article 25. Trauma patients without insurance taken off life support sooner. So if you're thinking that medical care is immune to the effect of payment sources, it's not true. Those are very expensive. And of course, that's usually the institution that has the person in it that ends up getting those costs, and keeping a trauma patient alive on life support can be very expensive. Bonus article 26, if you build it, they will come. Emergency departments are victims of induced demand. So that's kind of an economics term. If you're kind of a healthcare geek, this would be a good one to read. But the bottom line is more is not always more. That just building more emergency departments will not necessarily solve the waiting lines, etc. Bonus article 27, preventive care is under threat. PrEP, now or later. So PrEP is the HIV preventative drug that is, the Supreme Court had a ruling that allowed the complainants not to have to pay for that, and it could open a door for a lot of preventive care, or particularly PrEP specifically, to not be covered by employers. Bonus article 28, why many nonprofit, wink, wink, hospitals are rolling in money. Another good case study and litany of things that so-called nonprofit hospitals are doing that look very, very profit-driven. Bonus article 29, high CEO pay in large healthcare systems linked to hospital consolidations and not linked to profitability or community benefit. So this is kind of the rewarding, just bigger is better, these big healthcare consolidations. And whichever side of the, if you think that, you know, people should be rewarded for increasing profitability, well, it's not linked to that. You think it should be rewarded for providing community benefit, it's not linked to that. So much for the free market. We are all paying for the free market. Bonus article 30. A judge ruled a Louisiana prison healthcare system has failed inmates for decades. This is very egregious. A federal law to limit lawsuits, that is liability, could block reforms. Yikes. So liability limit reform could prevent Louisiana from actually reforming its failed medical care system for inmates. Bonus article 31. Too many pills? How to talk to your doctor about reviewing what's needed. So 13% of Americans are taking 5 or more prescription drugs. 42% of those over 65 are. So if you fall into one category of concern that you're taking too many prescription medications, this is a good review for how to talk to your doctor about that. Bonus article 32. Study shows people place little trust in medical advice if they suspect AI involvement. People actually want to interact with other people, not a machine. Bonus article 33. A call to action from 9 former U.S. cabinet secretaries. We need a national effort to protect patients against healthcare cyber attacks. So the healthcare sector in the U.S. is the most prone and apparently profitable for cyber criminals. So need to bolster efforts. That is a continuing challenge. Bonus article 34. Defying global trends. Study finds high happiness and low depression among the oldest generation of Americans. So this is an interesting kind of glitch, but really what I think it is that we have a generation that has benefited the most from the economic expansion of our industrial capitalist society, but their childhoods and early life appeared in a more pre, I don't know, postmodern, whatever you want to call it, time, say the 50s and 60s, where a lot of the problems of late stage capitalism have started to grind down our health as Americans. So they're in kind of a sweet spot, but they said specifically in this article, do not expect future generations to benefit from this. Bonus article 35, ripe for disaster declarations, heat, wildfire smoke, and death data. This is an interesting thing, kind of a call on FEMA, an emergency management agency, to deal with heat disasters and wildfire smoke. And of course, if you've got entire cities burning down, and you got dozens or hundreds of people, you know, dropping dead from heat, that makes a little bit of sense. But the kind of interesting thing I think about this from a public health perspective, a preventive point of view, is that this is sort of having FEMA dealing with health problems is kind of the opposite of prevention. It's mitigation at best. So I don't think, maybe if you want to talk about the people that die of respiratory disease or heart attacks from wildfire smoke, you'd have to declare it the whole country pretty much a disaster area. So it's kind of weird, and we need to become more prevention focused, not dealing with it after the fact. 36, people are still being swallowed by storm drains. One U.S. agency is pushing for safety measures. Believe it or not, about half a dozen Americans are swept down storm drains and killed each year. We need to put grates in those. Make grates in America again. Bonus article 37. A gigantic weather-defining current system could be headed to collapse within decades, shaking the scientific world struggling with uncertainties. This is my recommended long read for the day. A wonderful story of science and trying to deal in the real world of climate change, which has monumental consequences attached to it. But of course, it enters the political world, and there's a lot of uncertainties in science, but we need to make the best decisions, the best judgments we can with the uncertainties that we have to live. Good article. And a couple on the political front, bonus article 38, where Kamala Harris stands on healthcare issues. And bonus article 39, Kamala Harris offered a blueprint for environmental justice. Can she grow it? So it seems that Kamala Harris is probably a little bit to the left of Joe Biden, and that's on healthcare issues and environmental justice. You can view these and all the other stories I've reported on this and previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-